Welcome to another episode of Q&A at F&B, the show where we sit down with creative professionals to discuss things like process, workflow, the art, and the business side of making images. My name is Jeffrey Sidoris. You may have noticed that we took a little bit of a break after interviewing our last guest, photographer John Keatley. We actually got a chance to do some traveling. We spent some time in Joshua Tree and did some camping in Yosemite, but we are back. We have some great guests lined up, so let's just dive into today's show. If you're a photographer or you've spent any time at all on Faded and Blurred, chances are today's guest will be very familiar to you. As a photographer, he's allowed us to share in his journeys to exotic locales all over the world, such as Nepal, India, Vietnam, Tunisia, and Mongolia, to name a few. As a writer, his books Within the Frame, Vision Mongers, and Vision and Voice have encouraged us to find our own photographic vision and to shoot with purpose. And as the founder of Craft and Vision, he's assembled an amazing list of photographers and writers to produce a growing collection of ebooks that both educate and inspire for just $5 each. It's absolutely my pleasure to sit down once again with photographer, writer, and entrepreneur David Duschamon. Hello, David.
Hey, Jeffrey. How are you?
I'm doing really well. How are you?
I'm good.
What you been up to?
Well, you know, a little of this, a little of that, not a whole lot of walking.
a lot of television, a lot of writing.
You know what? No. A lot of writing, no television.
Yeah, you have been very prolific lately.
I've been writing a lot. You know, I'm assuming that probably most of your listeners, at least those that are familiar, know that late April I took a fall in Italy and broke both my feet, cracked my pelvis, and as a result I've been pretty immobile. I got back to Canada and had some surgeries and was in the hospital sort of for I think a total of 40 days. And once the pain meds kind of cleared out of my brain, I couldn't really do much else, and so I've been writing, and it's been refreshing actually to just mm-hmm. sit and just write for such an extended period of time.
Now, I would like to point out that you are doing well and expected to make nearly 100% recovery. Is that pretty fair?
Yeah, I'm doing well. Some days it's easier to put on a brave face than others, but I think recovery doesn't just happen. So just like photography or writing or anything, you get out of it what you put into it. So, you know, I'm working my butt off, and I think too a lot of it has to do with your attitude, and you can either enjoy the moment that you have to live right here and now, or you can, you know, decide to put that off and, oh, I'm not going to be happy until I can walk or until whatever that future thing is. And none of us are guaranteed that tomorrow. So I sort of have chosen just to enjoy this time. And once in a while, I kind of sit down on the veranda outside and have a beer and grumble and complain to myself that this is taking longer than expected. But yeah, I'm doing well. And as far as recovery, 100%, I'm not sure. They're certainly saying that I will, you know, that I will walk again. There's some question as to, whether I'll walk, for example, with or without a limp. There's just a lot of more questions than answers right now as far as what recovery will look like long term. But I'm alive, and the two previous people that fell off that wall in Italy didn't live. So, you know, very grateful that I'm,
oh my God.
Yeah. It's that wall has a bit of a history. I'm alive and I'm not paralyzed, and I can still pursue my work and the things I love. And, you know, there were no brain injuries or internal bleeding or, in fact, there was literally not a scratch on me. I fell, I landed on my feet, I crumpled, crushed multiple bones in both feet, cracked my pelvis, sprained my, at the time they thought my wrist had broken. So I was like, eventually I was casted 3 out of 4 limbs. Wow. Not doing a lot of anything, but like I said, you know, I'm not paralyzed, and I got off without a scratch, so to speak.
Yeah. So to speak.
Yeah. No scratches, lots of broken bones and stuff.
Yeah.
No scratches.
On the surface, everything's great.
Everything's fine. Yeah. It was only until the surgeons started digging around in there that I got these big scars. So.
Right. Well, I'd love to just kind of dive in, because there are so many things we haven't actually spoken since the last interview, which has been about a year.
Yeah, you never call anymore. What's with that?
your people say you're not available. but like I said, you have been very prolific. You've recently released a new ebook, A Deeper Frame. You've got Photographically Speaking coming out, looks like mid-October, you
That's
said?
That's right, yeah, mid-October.
So a lot going on. Mm-hmm. And Craft and Vision has been producing some stellar titles. So there's just a lot to talk about. But one of the things I did want to start with was... In the latest ebook, A Deeper Frame, you begin the book by saying, you will find this book refreshingly free of that word, talking about vision. What happened? What's wrong with vision?
Nothing's wrong with vision. Vision's still great. I think what happens is when you start talking, you know how if you write your name so many times, you start, or any word, you start looking at it and going, oh man, I'm not even sure if that word's spelled right. Is that even a word? You know, and I think the same thing happens with a concept, or I mean, a word like vision. I have been throwing it around for so long that I think at a certain point, people either get saturated or sick of it, or they're like, okay, we get it, let's move on. And I think the understanding of vision, I've even stopped using the word and talking instead about intent, mm-hmm. or using it interchangeably, because I think, I mean, when we talk about our photographic vision, we're using a metaphor, and people don't always get metaphors in the same way. And so intent, I think, is much closer to what I've been trying to communicate. So I will use it interchangeably, and I still use the word vision, but... at a certain point, too, you know, like I said, there were some people that said, okay, we get it, let's move on. Vision is all well and good, but unless you can express that vision, I mean, that's the point of this whole thing. And my countless ramblings about vision have been about expressing that vision, you know, that gear is good, vision is better. Well, the gear is good only in as much as it can express that vision. And so the next logical step for me, at least in my teaching and the way that I'm talking about photography, is to talk about vision in the context of expression. How do we express ourselves? How do we use that visual language? So nothing happened so much as I think I just, I came to the end of the line in terms of how much I could usefully talk about vision before we sort of said, okay, what's the next step?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Without having it become... Oh, he's talking about vision again. Here it goes again.
Yeah, well, we may have long passed that point. But, you know, at a certain point, I think, yes, I think there will always be people that get it early on and go, okay, move on already. And then there are others, myself included. I mean, you know, most of the time, most preachers are preaching first to themselves. And I just really needed to dig deep on this and see if I truly believed what I believed about the importance of the inner life of the photographer. And I got kind of to the end of my own search and went, yeah, actually I do. It's galvanized what I thought about vision. And now I'm ready to move on in my own work and to start talking about expression and how do we use the visual language of photography to out that vision? The vision's still inside. How do we out that vision?
Well, you've said that you're, one of your goals, at least, is to present a reaction to the life and the world around you, and try and be as honest as you can about that. So, can we interchange truth with vision? If we're searching for sort of a through line to what we're trying to communicate?
Yeah, certainly our reaction to the world around us. I think we could. I mean that depending on how we're using the word truth and what we think about, you know, whether that's a subjective thing or objective, or a subjective perspective on an objective thing. But certainly, you know, and I hate to say these words, but, you know, our truth, the way that we're seeing things in our own reality, our vision is, you know, we're constantly reacting to that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of what we're having on my blog, a discussion about originality right now. And I think that's part of what to be original is, because there's a lot of people that will say, well, you can't be original. There is no such thing as originality. And I that was my line at first, but I'm beginning to see that actually there is such a thing as originality, in a sense that we are unique people. We, in our sense, are, you know, originals. And the moments that we react to and how we react to them can, in fact, be original. Yes, it's derivative of other things. And yes, we're influenced by all kinds of kinds of things. But ultimately, that's what we've got. We've got, you know, our own vision and our own reality and the way that we respond or react to that reality.
So do you still feel, because you wrote on your blog that you felt that originality or maybe the search for originality is more of a burden or can be more of a burden. Do you still feel that way?
I do, actually. And it's a little bit like entrepreneurs that do what they do purely to chase the buck and to, mm-hmm. you know, to make money. I think there are some people for whom that is enough. But I think it can more often than not result in work that is inauthentic. I would rather pursue work that is authentic and honest. If you do that, you know, I wrote on my blog, be yourself, do the work, and the rest will follow. And I really truly believe that. I think if we pursue honest work that expresses ourselves in an honest way, and it'll grow just like, you know, just like our vision does, then we will end up with work more than likely that is, quote, original. Now, originality, you know, it's such a big word and it begs definition. And it's like the word art, you know, who's going to step up to the plate and define it? Well, certainly not me, but I think searching for originality can take us in such sort of a circuitous, distracted, it's just not the point. You know, for most of us, I think the point is creating work that's authentic to who we are. And you can search for originality and try to do original work, and all you end up with is stuff that's original, but not necessarily you. So, again, depends. Everyone photographs for different reasons. Everyone creates for different reasons. But I think most people would prefer to end up with work that is honest and true to who they are,
right,
than, quote, original. Because, again, if your search is for originality, you can end up in all kinds of weird places. And I find, too, a lot of the stuff that seems to be, it's almost like they're trying to be original. And as a result, it's just pretentious and it's clever and I don't understand it. And I feel like an idiot looking at it and going, I know I should like this stuff because everyone tells me I should because it's original, but it just,
They're like those prints you used to see in the mall that had, like, you know, swordfish or you know, penguins, and you had to, like, look beyond them to see them, and I could never see them, you know, the 3D with the dots or something.
Yeah, and three people come up behind you and go, oh
yeah, yeah, and I feel like an idiot because I'm, you know,
exactly,
yeah,
exactly,
yeah.
So I, you know, it's maybe a little bit like that. I think there are better things to pursue than originality, and it can, when you start chasing something so big as originality, it can be an extreme burden. You know, it's like sitting down to write a bestseller.
Right.
Don't worry about writing a bestseller. If you write something that is authentic and is excellent because your craft is, you know, you've shored up your craft and you're good at it, then it may become a bestseller and more power to you. But to sit down and write a bestseller, more than likely you're going to end up with something that's kitschy and cliched and,
right,
and worse, not a reflection of who you are, more a reflection of what you think the market wants.
An artist friend of mine calls it painting with someone else's brush.
Totally.
And I think that's spot on.
Yeah, absolutely.
If it seems that originality should be a byproduct of authenticity rather than sort of, you know, a goal in and of itself.
Absolutely. You know, and again, just, you know, I hate to say things that will end up being cliche, and everything we say has, you know, there's a yeah, but associated with it. But really, truly, just be yourself, do the work, and the rest will follow.
Does doing the work, a lot of photographers talk about the importance of personal projects in fueling the client-driven projects. Are you at a point now where you have become your own client, your only client in a sense, so that everything is somehow a personal project? Or are you still separating client work, personal work, or can you separate them?
Yeah, again, it's definitions, but I've worked very hard to get to the point where right now, at least, I am my only client. I took my last client work at the end of last year, and now I am literally my only client, and that means that I photograph for myself, in terms of personal work. I photograph for myself in terms of the ebooks. I photograph for myself for content for the blog and for my print books. Now, the advantage of being your own client, of course, is that you can shoot pretty much anything you want. If you say, hey, I want to go to Santa Fe and shoot, you know, shoot in Santa Fe for a month, then you can do that. The downside, of course, is that your client, who is you, is still going to be rattling around in your head going, okay, yeah, but you've got to create something that's going to, you know, make you a living in some way. So that's the downside of it. But at least I'm doing the work for myself as a client instead of, you know, a real live actual client breathing down my neck who will be demanding perhaps that I'm doing work that's not 100% how I would want to do it. And so I think creatively, this ability to be your own client, I think it's given me much greater creative freedom, which I really, truly appreciate, especially at this point where, you know, I can't work for anyone. And so it's a good thing that, you know, I have a boss that's understanding.
Right. Reluctantly so.
Reluctantly so, yeah.
Do you find that you're giving yourself barriers or obstacles or parameters to challenge you creatively when you approach a project, or how do you treat yourself as your own client?
Sometimes it's very intentional. Like, for example, illustrations for my teaching. The nice thing about teaching is that if you're always learning, you always have something to teach. And so by going out to experiment with things and give, for example, you mentioned A Deeper Frame. And so I wrote that book because I would have been exploring depth in my photographs myself. Mm-hmm. And so I can go out and I can say, okay, your constraint on this is to play with perspective, lines, depth. So I've been shooting almost exclusively lately over the last, well, certainly the last 6 months with wider angle lenses, 17 to 24, because there is a potential there. Not that you can't create images with depth with longer focal lengths, but I was really enjoying those tools and I just gave myself that constraint. So in that sense, giving myself as my own client, giving myself the constraints and saying, okay, these images may eventually end up in a book illustrating the concept of reintroduction of depth in our photographs, then that gives me that sort of that parameter. Mm-hmm. But I started writing the book because I wanted to explore this kind of thing. So it's not like I've given myself a constraint. I'm going, oh man, I wish I wasn't shooting this. I've given myself a very tight constraint within sort of this. It's play, you know, it's do the work, but it's playful because I'm enjoying just going out and shooting. So I don't know if that answered the question.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. You've talked about selectivity and how important, in a sense, editing is. And a friend of mine just did a great post on our job as artists, creatives, photographers, whatever discipline is editing. And is making choices about everything throughout the process. And I wonder, you know, without going into like a film versus digital kind of argument, because I don't think that's one that you can win or any of us can win,
or even care about.
Or even care about. but one of the things that I do question is whether or not digital and the ability to fill up a 32 gig card at 5 frames a second or 8 frames a second or whatever has desensitized us to be able to edit the moment or to be able to reflect and kind of see what you call more human moments.
Yeah, you know, I'm not really sure. I inevitably in conversations like this, at some point, as soon as the digital issue comes up, someone sort of raises the whole, you know, well, doesn't digital make us do this or doesn't it? And I'm not sure that it does anything except give us sort of an area of temptation, where it provides an opportunity for us to shoot like mad. But so does being a film shooter with deep pockets. I mean, you could go out with as many rolls as a film as you wanted, or load it up bulk and put on a bulk film back and, you know, shoot 144 frames or whatever. I think the question is, it's more about how intentional are we, how mindful are we? And I think the editing process is really important. There's this great movie that I It's one of my favorites. It's called The Wonder Boys, and it's brilliant. And Michael Douglas is playing this author who his first book was a runaway bestseller. It was an instant success, and he's been struggling with his second book. And one of his students comes in and sees that his second book that he's written, it's like it's boxes of pages, like thousands of pages. And she says to him, she says, you know, she starts reading it. And she goes, you just haven't made any choices. You know, like you've been waffling. And so it just goes on and on. And I think it's the same with our editing process. You know, I've talked to students that have this really complicated 5-star, 4-star, 3-star system. For me, and my way is certainly not the way everyone should do it, but for me, the image is either there or it's not. And so my edit is an extremely binary, like it's a 5-star or it's nothing. It's a yes or no. And I go through and it's like, yes, yes, no, no. Now, sometimes I'll star 3 images as a 5 and come back to them and go, okay, which one of these 3 yeses is really the yes? But then I don't downgrade the other 2 to a 4. It's still, it's either the image or it's not. And if you have to waffle between it, you're like, I don't know, is it this one or is this one a 4? Is this, it's like, if for me, again, for me, if it's not a 5 and you're sitting there, well, is it a 4? It doesn't matter.
Wow. Now,
some people have uses for that starring system, but for me, I want nothing except my best work out there. I was just reading a book called, Anything You Want by Derek Sivers. He's the guy that started CD Baby.
Mm-hmm.
And his sort of his decision-making process, he calls it hell yes or no. You're either really...
That's it. Those are the only 2 really choices.
Excited, exactly. So if you're not really excited about it, don't do it. He said, we've got so many choices anyway that why take on things that are like, yeah, I guess, kind of, sort of. Well, why put out work that you're like, well, it's a 3 or it's a 4? Now, again, maybe people are not putting out their work that's a 3 or 4, but in that case, for me, it's like it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I will go back later, even a year later or more, and review that. And sometimes an image that I cut out before comes back as a yes because I was looking for different things or I was trying to express something that now I look back and I've sort of a little bit forgotten what specifically made it a no image, but I go, oh yeah, that's a good one. So I think learning not only to edit in the moment, and some people will do it differently. But again, for me, it's like that one did it and that one didn't. And it will be a question of a glance or the light or just a nuance in the composition or the tension in the framing. But for me, I think I work better in that kind of yes or no. And I think that's, to answer your question about decisions, that's what matters is you've got to make choices, whether you're a writer, a sculptor, a painter, you've got to make decisions. And that, I think, is where understanding our own vision and our own intent comes in, because it makes it much easier than to look at a photograph and go yes or no, right? Did it or didn't it accomplish what I set out to do? Is it emoting the way I wanted to? Is it balanced the way I need it to be or imbalanced the way I need it to? But unless you can answer that question, how do you know whether it's a yes or no? How do you know whether it's a 3, a 4, or a 5? No. So again, it all comes back with great reluctance to vision.
Damn it. you talk about being aware as part of this sort of editing and even in the shooting process of being aware of the things that move you deeply and sort of letting those things that don't move you deeply fall away. Mm. How do you learn that? How do you learn to let yourself be moved in a sense and let go of, am I at the right shutter speed? Am I at the right F-spot? Am I this? Am I that? And focus, pardon the pun, on the emotional content of a situation, of an image or of a setting.
I have no idea. I think a lot of it has to do with, like anything in life, it sort of evolves a little bit. And when we first start out in photography, you start out with, there's a reason that you started. Some people start because they love playing with the gear. Some people start because they just, you know, they have this magic moment in the dark room. There's a lot of different reasons people start, but eventually everyone sort of, you know, moves on. And I think there's like a photographic adolescence that we go through that it's really important that we just grow beyond that. It's that we will have a stage where we're infatuated with the gear. We'll have a stage where we're imitating the masters. We'll have this stage, you know, where we are just kind of fleshing it out. But at a certain point, I think, and it, I don't know that there's any rite of passage or graduation, but you wake up one day and you know, you're, I don't know how to put it, you know, you just, you wake up and suddenly some of those things don't matter anymore. The only thing that matters is the photograph. And more than that, the content of the photograph, what does it mean? What is it saying? And I had this really interesting moment in Florida when I was on this road trip with my truck, and I was sitting reading a magazine called Overland Journal, which is, it's this fantastic magazine about these lunatics from all over the world who spend, you know, time in trucks like mine. I have a 1983 Land Rover Defender that I'm have been living in for the last while and exploring, and I was reading these articles, and it's, you know, it's I mean, it's people talking about how to drive in the desert and this great road trip they took with a Royal Enfield motorcycle through, you know, the Grand Canyon. And reading these stories, I suddenly had this realization that, you know what? It's not photography that I'm in love with. Mm-hmm. It's the adventure and the travel and the people that I meet. And when you have that moment of realization that I love photographs, but it's what this all allows me to participate in and express, I think that it becomes much more, it becomes easier just to look at your work and go, okay, that does it or that doesn't do it for me. Mm-hmm. Because you're not infatuated with, oh, but this one really, sometimes we play games with ourselves, you know, we convince ourselves that, well, I shot this one with a lens that just cost me $2,500 or $1,000 or whatever. It really better be good.
Right, right, right.
We play these mind games with ourselves. This is my favorite lens right now, and so these are the pictures. But it just might not be working. Like, maybe it's time to go back to that $80 Nifty 50.
You keep chipping away at it until you get to, well, it's sharp.
Right. Exactly. I love how sharp it is. Yeah.
It doesn't say anything, but it's really sharp.
It's really sharp. And, you know, there's this story that, and I wish I could remember where I read this, but there's the anecdotal story about this younger photographer and this master photographer, and the younger photographer brings back photographs every year for the master to look at, and the master separates the images into two piles. The great photographs and the garbage. And every year, the master takes the same photograph and puts it in the garbage pile. And one year, finally, he says, look, every year you keep putting this photograph back into the pile, and I keep telling you it's crap. Why do you keep putting it in the pile? And the photography student said, well, I've had to work so hard to make that photograph. And that just, I heard that story and it just twigged something in me, because I thought, you know, yeah, it's exactly it. If you spend a year of your life writing a book, you're going to defend that book push it and push it and push it. And you may get 100 rejection letters. Now, that's not necessarily a reflection of whether the book is good or not. I mean, literary history is full of that story, and then suddenly it becomes a bestseller. However, I think we shouldn't be blinded by something's either works or it doesn't. Something's either good or it's not. And sometimes the lens we shot it with, or how long it took us to get to the location, it's like we get so seduced by the exotic nature of travel that we show up in India and people say, oh, you can't even take a bad photograph there. Well, I've seen them, you know. You can. It turns out
you really can.
A Flickr is full of them. And my hard drive is full of them. You know, it's just because you've paid $2,500 for a plane ticket and gone on safari doesn't mean that the photographs are good.
Right.
You make a portrait of a man with a turban doesn't mean it's a good photograph, or even an honest, or, you know, insert favorite word that you want to describe photographs here.
Yeah. Stuart Sapigal told a funny story about going on safari, and the first moment they sort of, you know, see a lion or a cheetah or something, he said it's like machine gun fire. Everybody's camera just, you know, everybody getting the same exact shot of this cheetah, rather than, you know, sort of waiting for a moment.
Yeah, and there's, I think, to expand on that story, because I lead safaris every year too, photographically, you know, with a photographic purpose, and we have these exact same moments. And what's really telling is 2 days later, when you see an elephant, people will be like, ah, it's just an elephant, right? And so you've got to punch through that, and you've got to become so familiar with your subject that you can still say, ah, it's just an elephant, but then make a great photograph.
Right. Talk a little bit, if you wouldn't mind, about, you know, we talked a little before we started recording about your love affair with this itinerant or even nomadic lifestyle. For those people that it resonates with, it seems to become a part of the fabric of them. And that seems to be what has happened with you.
Yeah, it really unexpected. I mean, I've always been a traveler. My last name in French, Du Chemin, means of the road. And so I was kind of, you know, I was fated to be a traveler, and was the, you know, the child of a British RAF nurse and a Canadian soldier. You know, I mean, we traveled the world. They met in Cyprus, and, you know, and so I grew up my early years traveling. And then the last number of years, I've spent time sporadically with nomads in Africa and in India, and have so enjoyed my connections with them and seeing the simplicity of their lifestyle. Now, often that simplicity is also kind of forced by poverty, so I don't want to romanticize that in any way. But the simplicity of how do I put it? Just simply not being owned by your possessions. They are free to just pick up their entire houses and move them. Mm-hmm. And again, not to romanticize the poverty aspect of that kind of lifestyle, which unfortunately, especially with nomadic groups, they're increasingly becoming sort of climate change refugees. Right. And the poverty issues are growing with nomadic groups. But there was something about that simplicity. And, you know, I had a number of sort of events in my life that just made me think, now is the time. And so I gave up my apartment, and the woman that, it was a rented condo, and the woman that came in and sort of took the lease up from me, she bought almost all my stuff, furnitures and household things. And so when I moved in, my storage locker is just really filled with books and personal effects. Wow. and the gear that I didn't bring with me, and the rest, whatever would fit into the back of the Land Rover, is what I travel with and live with. And even now, when the Land Rover's in Atlanta, when her name's Jessie, when Jessie comes back up to be reunited with me finally at last, I will probably cull some of that stuff out. And now I've added some other stuff, like some solar stuff to try to, you know, generate my own power. But I want to live simply. And it has, to come back to your question, it's been such a surprise, because I've truly never been so content. I mean, I wake up in the morning in the weather. I mean, I have a rooftop tent on the top of the Land Rover, and, you know, it's camping every night. Mm-hmm. And I wake up in the weather, surrounded by the elements, and it's just, there's something about the simplicity of it that has really resonated with me and allowed me to slow down, really, really slow down. And just when I thought I couldn't get any slower, I broke my feet. So, you know, just when I thought Zen left.
Someone right. Telling you, really, Duchemin, you want to slow down? Okay.
Really? You think you're slowing down? So you slow down. And, but it really has. I mean, I have never been so content, and I think that's, you know, I'm hesitant to use the word happy, because that can be so circumstantial, but just content. I mean, to wake up in Monument Valley and look out at these incredible vistas and think, do I want to move on today? Yeah. I want to stay here? Do I want to keep shooting? Do I want to, and just to have that freedom. And I, you know, not everyone can arrange, you know, orchestrate their lives in a way that they can do that, but everyone can arrange their life in a way that the things that matter to them end up at the top. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's been so striking to me is people continually saying, oh, I wish I could do that. I wish I could do that. And what they really mean is, I wish I could do that without changing anything else in my life.
Right.
Because people say, oh, I don't have enough time. Well, how much TV have you watched in the last week? How much time have you spent on Twitter or Facebook? That's not to say any of those things are not worthwhile pursuits or can't contribute positively in our lives, but how much time are we really giving these things at the expense of things that are truly priorities that we long to do? Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing with money. You know, any of our resources can be reprioritized in a way. And a lot of people will say, well, I have children, I can't. Well, I mean, I traveled as an Army brat. I traveled. I have friends that travel with their kids to the most remote places. They just simply make changes in the lifestyle, and the kids don't go to soccer camp. The kids, you know, get on a plane and go to South America with their parents, but they're becoming amazing human beings. I mean, these kids, have been introduced to new cultures and new languages, and they've learned how diverse and big the world is. So yes, there's some risks, and yes, your kids could get malaria, but you know, it's a bigger risk that your kids would never see beyond their own backyard.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, to me, I think I would rather be a more enriched human being and take a few more chances, you know, even if I were a parent, and I'm not, so I'm kind of unqualified to speak about
this. Right. In the last talk, you and I touched on the nature of spirit and vision, and whether spirit, or how, to what extent spirit drives vision. Has leading this sort of nomadic or itinerant lifestyle, what, if anything, has that done to that connection between you and something greater than you? And, you know, call it God, call it whatever you'd like. What has that done to that relationship?
That's a really good question. I hesitate to be compartmental about it. And so, you know, again, your vision comes out of who you are, and who you are comes out of your relationship with life and with others. And, you know, I think I'm a pretty deeply spiritual person, and have a pretty strong personal faith. I'm not sure strong is actually the right word, very important personal faith. And so as that changes, your vision changes. So, you know, I've gone through a lot in the last year and a half. I've seen a lot of people begin to struggle. You know, you get to a certain age, your friends start getting cancer, mm-hmm. and people start dying, and parents, you know, start dying. And I think you can't help but experience these things and interact with them, you know, and be changed by them and understand priorities in a new way. And when you begin to appreciate people in a new way, things change. The way I photograph people has changed dramatically. If you look at the work I've done over the last year, apart from client work in my humanitarian stuff, I have photographed very few people. Mm-hmm. I'm beginning to photograph the natural world a lot more. And in part, that's because I'm much more selective about who I photograph. But it's also a little bit, because I'm starting to value people more, I'm sorting out my own way of photographing them. And the whole, you know, stick a camera in someone's face approach, which I've never subscribed to, but my reluctance to photograph people, I guess the best way I can say it, my reluctance to photograph people has risen. And so as a result, more selective. And at the same time, just my being out in the wilderness and experiencing the beauty around me, I've thought, you know what, maybe I should take a break a little bit from photographing people. So it's changed. And, you know, I truly believe you can find God in the faces of people. And I truly believe you can find God in the wilderness. And the wilderness has been my cathedral for the last, you know, until I fell off the wall. And then, you know.
Although you could argue that the 40 days in the hospital was your wilderness.
You absolutely could. There certainly are biblical mm-hmm. Parables there. And, you know, again, we learn and we grow. And I think you can spend your 40 days in the desert bitching and complaining that you don't have food or water, or you can spend it and realize I'm growing. I am becoming, through this experience, a different person. And I like to think that for the most part, that's how I've approached my recovery. And I have. I've learned so much. I've learned so much about slowing down. I've learned so much about gratitude. There are a lot of things, you know, I look at gratitude as a spiritual discipline and things like that, that I thought I'd learned that lesson. Mm-hmm. I really thought I was a grateful person until I went through this. And I realized I wasn't remotely. And not only was I not as grateful, I was grateful, but I wasn't as deeply grateful. It wasn't something that I just had to get out. And now I'm just so grateful. I want to say thank you to everyone I meet. Part of that's because I'm Canadian and we just do that anyway.
You guys are way nicer than we are.
Yeah, it's true. And I apologize for that.
You're apologizing on our behalf. have you seen your friend who I follow, Mike Todd, mm-hmm. posted a great series of videos called the Airstream Musings. Have you seen these between Brian McLaren?
No.
There are a series of videos between conversations, really, between Brian McLaren and David Wilcox. And they're absolutely wonderful. We'll put them in the show notes. And I'm going to paraphrase one of Brian McLaren's questions to David Wilcox, because I think that this is a kind of a perfect segue on the idea of gratitude. And he says, when you think of, and he asks about a musician, but we'll insert, when you think of a photographer or a writer who has heightened your care factor about something, who is it and how has that affected you?
Wow.
Isn't that a great question?
Yeah, that's a really, I love the word heightened your care for something.
Yeah, heightened your care factor. I love that.
You know what? Offhand, I'm not sure, and I'll respond to this coming around the back end. But gosh, you know what? If I could have someday, if people were asked that question and the answer were me, that would be a lofty life goal. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would love to be the kind of person that does that for other people, that has the kind of influence where you heighten people's care for something. I think that's really noble. Honestly, everyone that I read, I mean, if I make it through a book, it's because I've chosen halfway through the book to keep going and it's made me care. I'm having a really hard time answering that. I mean, all the way through my photographic career, there have been little points of light, you know, I mean, people like Steve McCurry, and I know it's almost cliche to say, but you know, he was doing important work, and mm-hmm. he showed, even through that image, you know, the Afghan girl that has, again, you know, it's become almost cliche to say, oh, I saw the Afghan girl and I decided to become a photographer. Yet that's part of my story, and it made me care in a new way. And you know, 25 years later, here I am as a humanitarian photographer who still cares and is doing that work. I came about it through such a circuitous route, but obviously that was an influence. And there are photographers now that still, you know, that still influence me. I don't know if I can answer that in a way that sounds terribly profound. I mean, there are people right now, my big photographic crush is Elliot Erwitt, mm-hmm. and his stuff, just, I love it because it's so, one of the things when, and I suspect this is true of many people, when you have a life-changing event that makes you understand that life is short and life is beautiful and that the moment is just so important. That's one of the things photographers have, right? I mean, that's one of our raw materials is the moment.
Sure.
And so, coming to understand the importance of the moment. And Elliot Erwitt just has this way of, I don't know, the moment plays so strongly on his stage, you know, and you look at some of these photographs where sometimes it's comedic and there's an irony or a juxtaposition in the photograph. Other times it's just, there's this photograph he made of Robert Frank and his wife in a kitchen kissing that is this beautiful, almost voyeuristic, like it's almost like he's come around the corner and caught this tender moment. Mm-hmm. But it's just, however he accomplished it is a beautiful, beautiful human moment. And I look at, you know, work like his and I just, it stuns me, you know, and it makes me appreciate the moment more, because it's easy to be seduced by beautiful light.
Right.
It's easy to be seduced by some of these, you know, bright colors. And, you know, I mean, at the risk of starting an all out, you know, flame war, you know, on your website, I think that's one of the reasons why poorly done HDR photographs, and you knew it was coming, but poorly done. Hear what I'm saying?
What's the word? Done, what's the word? Mediocre-er.
Mediocre, poorly done HDR photographs still resonate with people, particularly the non-photographic world, because, one, I think because they're novel and they're, quote, painterly. But the other, I think, is simply because they make light look less mundane than it can be, and we get seduced mm-hmm. by things like that. Now, I am not for a minute saying that HDR as a technique, like any other technique, cannot be used well, and I've seen it used well. I did hear an apocryphal story that makes me laugh, and I've told this story a couple times, and each time I wonder if I should call Joe and ask him for verification. But I heard that Joe McNally, and again, maybe totally apocryphal, insert name of any photographer here, but I heard that Joe was at a conference, a photography conference, and he popped his head in on one of these workshops, and it happened to be an HDR workshop. And the instructor said, again, totally apocryphal, maybe, instructor said, "Hey, ladies and gentlemen, look, it's Joe McNally. Joe, any words of wisdom to share with us?" And Joe said, according to the story, said, "Well, I don't know what are y'all learning?" And the guy said, "Oh, this is an HDR workshop." And Joe said, or apocryphal Joe said, "Oh, great. So instead of taking one mediocre photograph, you're taking nine and layering them all together." And I thought, you know what? That's so true. And it's not necessarily true of all HDR. And HDR, I have seen beautiful HDR work. And I would not, I would, without hesitation, as a publisher, I would publish a book on HDR done right. And we're discussing that as a, you know, as a team. But, so I'm not criticizing HDR. I'm just criticizing any technique that becomes an unsuck filter.
Right. Right.
I think, you know, I think is we need to be wary of it, because there are more important things that we can be doing with our photographs. We can be pointing to things like a moment and saying, look at this. HDR doesn't say, again, as a technique, anytime we elevate it and just go, this is good because I use this technique.
Right, right, right.
Because it's black and white. Someone say, well, do you like black and white photographs? That's not the point. Do you like HDR photographs? Not the point. You know, well, do you like photographs taken with a wide angle lens? Again, not the point. The point is, what is that photograph saying? Whether you used 100 techniques all together or just, you know, randomly shot it with your iPhone. The point is, what does the photograph say? What's the moment? What's, and sometimes we get seduced by things like, you know, a guy in a turban or great light. And Elliot Erwood has this way of showing the moment in a way that just makes me just go, I'm just going to hang up my camera.
Time to go work at Starbucks.
In an inspiring kind of, you know, resignation.
Right, right, right. In a very humbling way of hanging up your camera. Yeah.
Yeah. And at some point you let those things kind of settle in, and then you pick up your camera again and you go and you photograph, not to duplicate any of Elliot Erwitt's work. His work is his own, mm-hmm. but to go in and go, okay, with the appreciation that the moment really matters and comic timing, you know, the moment, the timing, you know, in comedy is so important. That's why some of Elliot's work seems so funny, mm-hmm. you know, seems to have this wit about mm-hmm. it.
But you can certainly let that inform your work without saying, I'm going to go shoot an Elliot Erwitt picture, or I'm going to shoot a Jay Mazel picture or something.
Yeah, and you should allow the books that you read and the movies you see. And, you know, I'm a big fan of getting out of the photography ghetto and going and experiencing the art world, mm-hmm. you know. Read some poetry, read novels, watch movies. I mean, cinema is close enough that, you know, I'd even put it certainly into the photography world. But, you know, go watch live dance, go to the museum, go look at the painters, go to Paris and visit the Louvre and the Musée d'Orsay and experience something larger and allow all of that to influence what you do. You know, allow your relationships and, you know, the dinner you had with, you know, with your girlfriend last night, allow all of that to affect mm-hmm. your photography. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, a Steve McCurry photograph or an Elliot Erwitt photograph.
It in some level, it comes back to the Mazel story of becoming a more interesting person.
Yeah, and become your own interesting person. You know, it shouldn't be enough to put your tripod potholes anywhere you know, that someone else has been, unless you're pursuing your own thing. I mean, what's the value in recreating something? I mean, it's like paint by numbers. Like, is that satisfying our creative drive? Mm-hmm. It may have use in learning, but beyond the, I mean, if you have to learn, but no one puts, I mean, writers will famously, as they learn, they'll try to copy a style of someone, you know, okay, I'm going to sit down and write something in the style of Hemingway. But just because it's in their notebook doesn't mean they have to publish it.
Right.
I mean, I don't think, do writers have the equivalent of Flickr where we just put up every piece of garbage that we write,
you know? And hope for a hug? So.
And yeah, and hope for a hug and a hey, attaboy.
You know? That sentence was awesome.
Way to yeah. use that. Yeah, a wicked yeah. sentence, dude.
Great comma.
I just, it's, and I don't at all mean I hope anyone that knows me knows I'm an avid fan of the amateurs, and I go to places like Flickr at times. I will be inspired by stuff that by someone I've never heard sure. of, and you know, I'm looking at stuff and going, oh my gosh, like this is really beautiful work. And that's what I love Twitter for, is once in a while someone will comment, and these days it's that 500
pixels. There's some beautiful yeah, work up there. There's some really beautiful work.
and some really discouragingly beautiful work. Like, you can spend hours looking at it, and it has nothing to do with someone as a quote or a professional or an amateur. And I have nothing against Flickr per se, but there is a movement where, you know, mediocre, and it's been this way since probably the dawn of time, where mediocre artists tell mediocre artists that everything's good and we pat each other on our backs, when we should be looking for cheerleaders as well as critics who will say, this is, you're repeating yourself. This
maybe not so much on this one.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, and everyone needs that. I need that. I have people in my life that look at my work and go, you know, I like what you're trying to do here, but I didn't even come close.
Right.
You know, but see the effort and let's explore that more, because all of our work is about process. You know, I mean, we could have a whole conversation about the rhythm of the creative process and the evolution of it and how it grows. But, you know, so I don't mean to pick on anyone, you know, camp or anything. I just think we need to be careful not to worship our own. There's a great quote, you know, let me see if I can pull it up, because I have it right sitting on my desktop. There's this great quote by this guy, and the reason I'm looking it up is because I can't remember his name. He's, you know, some really obscure Russian guy.
But who just happens to find home on your desktop.
Who just happens to be on my desktop. Konstantin Stanislavski.
Okay.
And I hope I didn't butcher that, but I think I got it right. And he says, love the art in yourself, not yourself in the art. And I love that, because yourself in the art, you're just looking in a mirror and go, man, I'm good.
Right.
But if you love the art yourself, you will do anything to make that art better, including going back, sacrificing, you know, I mean, I call it sacrificing my children, when the photograph that you thought was going to be a 5-star, you bring it up and, you know, on your computer, and it's like you get the monitor shock, right? Oh, it's such a great picture, and you bring,
rather than just pulling your eye away from the camera going, nailed it, you know, and moving on. Yeah,
exactly. You know, you look at it and you sit with it, and then you go, you know what? It's not my best work.
Yeah.
It's, and you just, you know, I call them sketch images. You consider it a sketch image, and not every painter just goes blam, throws the paint on the canvas, you know, with some brush strokes, and there it is.
Signs it.
Sometimes
the way
they scrape the paint off.
Yeah.
Exactly. So there's no reason why we shouldn't, when we have one that we really think we nailed, and then, you know, as we look at it, we go, you know what? I didn't. It's just, again, it's being honest with yourself and giving yourself the freedom not to have to be original, not to have to be prolific. I mean, why do we think we need to create 50 great photographs in one weekend? I'm going out to shoot, and I'm going to come back with a whole new portfolio. Well, good for you. But, you know, I mean, very rarely will any artist of any other discipline, I'm just going to sit down this afternoon and write and produce a whole album.
Right.
I'm going to create a whole new sculpture. Art is slow. You need to slow down, and better that it take time and it be an honest reflection or expression of who we are and our experience with whatever, than that we just, you know, get it out there. Because I'm not sure. I think the process is more important in some ways than the product, you know, because we'll always grow and change. We create something, and 3 years later, in the moment, we'll be like, this is the best thing I ever made. 3 years later, we'll look at it and go,
I wouldn't buy that now, or I wouldn't hang that now, but back then, you would have. Yeah,
exactly. And I think that quote, love the art in yourself, not yourself in the art, properly understood, I think is very, very helpful. Yeah.
Well, sir, I know that you are having to get out, and I appreciate you taking some time. Thank you so much. It was really great to sit down with you again.
Pleasure. You too. Thank you.
Is, as if people don't know, but we can remind them anyway, where can they find more about you?
The best place is just to go to my blog, and you can either go to daviddusheman.com, or if you have a hard time with that one, pixelatedimage.com. Both just take you to the same place, so they can find me on the blog, or I'm on Twitter at pixelatedimage. And that's where I make my home in terms of social media and connecting kind of with the world in terms of, you know, interacting and that sort of thing. So, and then of course my eBooks and the eBooks of some really great photographers, people that I learned from and that I'm friends with, are available on craftandvision.com.
I'm loving, just as a side note, I'm loving Corwin's new book.
Thank you. He did a great job. Corwin's, not just my manager. I mean, he's easily my best friend, and he just has done just an amazing job in talking about creativity. And sadly, I think a lot of people, you know, we still, I mean, Corwin's book just will not sell as well as a book about how to, you know, expose your photographs.
Right.
Well,
right.
And it's sad because our creativity is our greatest asset. And I think sometimes we just don't give that enough. So anyway, Corwin's book about creativity is brilliant. And it will also I think, be misunderstood as a book only for people that are doing this, quote, professionally. You know, people sort of look at their creativity and don't put a value on it unless it's producing for a client. And the fact is, you got to please yourself mm-hmm. first. Before you have clients, you've got to please yourself first and your creativity. That is our biggest asset. And so, yeah, he's done a great, great job.
On that note, thank you very much for taking the time. I really appreciate you being here.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I hope we can go not another year without talking.
Yeah, let's promise I'll call. If my people send you away, then unless it's a restraining order, just
hey, nothing you can prove.
That's funny. That's what my lawyer said you would say.
All right. Thank you, sir.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And that's a wrap on this episode of Q&A at F&B. I'd like to thank David Duschenman for taking the time to join us. It's always a pleasure to talk to him. If you would like to find out more about David or interact with him on his blog, you can find him at daviddusheman.com or pixelatedimage.com. You'll also find links to his portfolios as well as information about his books, including his newest book, Photographically Speaking, which hits the store shelves in mid-October. If you'd like to send us a note, let us know if there's somebody that you'd like to hear from on Q&A at F&B. We'd love to hear from you. Send it to info@fadedandblurred.com, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Just follow the links at fadedandblurred.com. And if you like the show, we'd love it if you'd leave us a rating or a short review on the iTunes Music Store. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.